This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. After 7 weeks of being frozen in place by the resignation of Ohio House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger under a cloud of accusations and an FBI investigation, the dominant Republican majority took 11 roll call votes on Wednesday before declaring Ryan Smith of Bidwell the new speaker. The next day, the House passed the payday lending bill that got Rosenberger in trouble in the first place. With every member up for election in November, Republicans hope voters will forget the scandal that created this mess. Trouble in Columbus is not limited to the House chamber. The administration has had to push back the start of the medical marijuana system approved 2 years ago. To discuss statewide issues, we are joined by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles and Cincinnati Enquirer state government reporter Jesse Bollmert. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk at WVXU. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, Joe. Jesse?
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
So, Joe, let's just start with the vote itself. I mean, this went on for hours.
Yeah.
You know, everything was behind doors up until this point. We have to assume it was pretty ugly behind doors because they couldn't figure anything out.
Right.
Why did they finally come out, and why did they do it this way?
Well, last week, the acting head of the Ohio House, Kirk Schuring, floated two different options. One was an option that he came up with when talking to the chair of the Republican Party and Larry Householder, who wants, he's the former Ohio House Speaker, who also wants to run again for Ohio House Speaker next year. That option, option one, was basically keep a placeholder in there, and at that point it was Andy Thompson, and have them placehold for the next 6 months and then, you know, go with someone new in January. The other option was to hold a vote and let the person who got the most votes, not necessarily the majority, but a plurality, let that person lead the House for the next 6 months. And lawmakers chose to go ahead and hold the vote and do that. But in the process of that, Ohio law stipulates that when you hold a vote for a speaker and they don't get a majority, then you have to go through this long involved thing where you have to vote 10 different times. And then after that 10th time, the next time you vote, the 11th time, they can take the person who had the plurality. Ryan Smith was just shy of the number of votes that he needed. Representative Ryan Smith, he was the finance chair, is the finance chair. And he was just shy of that threshold. So they had to go through all these votes. It took 3 hours on, I might tell you, very hard seats to sit on. And it was weird. It was just weird. And it was the lawmakers even thought it was weird because you could tell when they were answering, some of them were having fun with their answers and the way that they, you know, described the person they were voting for or whatever. And it was probably one of the more bizarre moments that I've experienced or hours I've experienced since I've been down here at the State House, and I've been here for about 20 years. So,
well, Jesse, normally you get in these situations in a political standoff like this and somebody begins to trade something for votes. Was there just nothing to trade between Republicans? Because Andy Thompson and Jim Hughes were both term limited out. So, you know, was there nothing to give them to have one of them sort of shift over to Ryan Smith? And what about with Republicans? Couldn't have they made some sort of deal with, or pardon, with the Democrats? Couldn't they have made some sort of deal? Was there just nothing to trade?
So I think a lot of the discussions about trades and like who would jump over to whose party was happening over the past several weeks when they were unable to come to a conclusion. And so this vote was the result of really not being able to make those trades. And so by the time we were doing this on Wednesday, it just seemed like this is how this is going to go. Kirk Schuring, who was presiding over the proceedings and who was the interim speaker, really just kept calling the votes one after another. So there, unless you were text messaging a lawmaker on the other side of the aisle, it would have been pretty hard to deal during those couple hour periods. There was a point where one Republican lawmaker wanted to take like a 20-minute break to say, oh, maybe we could caucus and, you know, come up with some solution here in between, I think, like the eighth and ninth votes. but Schering said no, and most of the people assembled also said no. So I think what you saw over 10 votes was Ryan Smith, who was the ultimate winner, had 44 votes the entire time. Two of those were from Democrats.
And he needed 46 in order to have an outright mm-hmm. majority.
Yep. And then Fred Strayhorn, who is the top Democrat in the Ohio House, had 28, only at the last point, 27 votes the entire time. So those numbers were staying very, very static. And then the numbers that kept going back and forth were the Thompson and Hughes people. And I think the point of that was just to say there are 19 Republicans who don't think Ryan Smith is the person that should lead this chamber. And they were making a statement of sorts that we're going to push this until the end.
So given that, is Ryan Smith temporary until after the election in November, and will Householder come in here and be able to claim the speaker's position?
Well, I don't know, Willie. Householder could run and is expected to run in January. Ryan Smith is also expected to run to keep this seat. And so this appointment, this vote, was only for the next 6 months. And you think, well, that's only 6 months. Why all this fuss? Well, number one, the person who's leading for the next 6 months might be perceived as having a little bit of a hand up. But another big important thing is there's about $4 million sitting in a House caucus campaign committee. And the person who is the leader of the House will have some say in where that's directed, where those dollars go. So that was a big thing in this next 6 months is, you know, having Ryan Smith there. He may direct those funds to candidates who are more likely to support him in January. But Larry Householder intends to run, at least at this point in January, and who knows where this is going to, you know, I'm not even going to conjecture where this is going to go.
Right. Well, Jesse, the next day, the House did pass the payday lending bill. And for Cincinnatians, Bill Seitz, what a surprise, had another point of view on the whether this was wise or not to pass this. He voted against passing it. So what was at stake there?
So essentially, these are some restrictions on the payday lending industry. A lot of people think, oh, didn't we take care of this with a vote in 2008? Well, the industry was largely able to get around those restrictions by just, you know, not filing under the manner that was prescribed in that item that the voters overwhelmingly passed. And so this would be a number of restrictions on like how long loans could be and so forth. And it has been controversial because payday lending is controversial generally. There is an added layer because Cliff Rosenberger, who you mentioned, the former speaker, he left amid an FBI probe. One of the things that, you know, we expect they were looking at were some trips that he took to Europe with lobbyists who were affiliated with the payday lending industry. And the implication being, you know, maybe this bill wasn't moving very quick because of that. Rosenberger has denied any wrongdoing in this, so it's still a little bit up in the air. But this is a bill that has been very contentious because of the topic, very contentious because of this FBI investigation. And Bill Seitz, who always has a very colorful opinion on the House floor, basically is concerned that this would completely wipe out the industry and that it is something that people use, especially if they have poor credit, especially if they have, you know, less access to maybe the banks or credit unions that other people would go to. So he and actually Tom Brinkman and George Lang, so a number of Southwest Ohio lawmakers were opposed to this bill.
You know, one thing to note there is, you know, Seitz raised this point, and I think a couple of the other lawmakers said, you know, the laws right now prevent banks from going in and actually being able to loan to the population that's served with payday loans because they are capped at a certain amount of interest. They can't do some things. And so they said, you know, if you really want to get these payday loans, you know, under control, maybe banks should be able, you know, change the banking laws so that these banks can do that.
Yeah. And any real support for that in the long run, even though this passed as is?
I don't know. I don't think there's any, I'm not aware of any bills right now that would actually change the banking industry so that it could do that.
Right. Okay. One of the arguments about having a vacancy in the speaker's position is that there's been a lot of bills that have been backed up that the House hasn't been able to do its job, take action. What are some of the most important things that, in your mind, Jesse, have been backed up?
So on Thursday, we got a look at a little bit of the things that have been backed up. The Ohio House passed 17 of their own bills and concurred on, I believe, 11 of the Senate's bills. We sent almost a dozen bills to John Kasich's desk. So this is kind of an indication of the backlog. But there are still about 150 bills that are sitting below the line, which is to say they've passed committee, but they haven't gotten a vote on the floor. Now, not all of those bills were going to get a floor vote no matter what, but it is a very large backlog, the likes of which we have not seen in recent years. So some of the more interesting ones, obviously the payday lending bill that we discussed was something that they passed out. Another item would provide millions of dollars to counties to fix their or get new voting machines. Some of these are aging and have been kind of cobbled together, so that's something. But even like smaller things, like there was a bill from Bridget Kelly and Tom Brinkman from our area that would allow vets to get continuing education credits for participating in free spaying and neutering. So these are things that are pretty bipartisan, things that most people can agree with, but they just haven't been able to take a vote on because they haven't had session, because they haven't had a leader.
Okay.
Another one that they talked about was getting better data on drug overdoses and the use of overdose reversing drugs and so forth. And as people who obviously know a lot about Ohio's drug epidemic, I mean, it's just helpful to have more up-to-date information about that. So
okay.
A lot of bills that weren't controversial that really could do some good in Ohio that were just sitting there.
The Ohio Department of Commerce announced this week that medical marijuana will not go on sale on September 7th, the target date. What's the holdup? We are joined today by Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles and Cincinnati Enquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmer. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. So what is the situation, Joe, with where we stand with the licensing of and what's and sort of where's the holdup in getting the marijuana situation, medical marijuana situation, moving?
Well, as you know, the licenses were dispersed to the large cultivators toward the end of last year. And there were some questions about validity back then because there were questions raised about the scores, and one of them had a criminal background, and there was the, hey, are you favoring this one over that one? And we've seen court battles, and there's been all kinds of questions raised. But at the end of the day, what needed to happen in order for medical marijuana to be available in those dispensaries in September is it needed to be in the ground now. They needed to plant it in May. Well, right now, there is not a single of the large cultivators right now who have marijuana in the ground. There is, as far as the smaller cultivators, they don't either. There have been no licenses issued. There are going to be possibly a couple of inspections in June and some more in July, at least they're planned. The one inspection that has occurred right now, the license didn't get issued because it didn't meet, the facility didn't meet the guidelines. So they're going to have to come back. But once they get their license, then that's when they plant. And it's typically, now it can range because it depends on what you're growing marijuana for, but an average is about 1,000 days that it takes to grow this marijuana. So if you do the math, even if they were to get the license next week, you know, putting it in the ground and getting it grown and then getting it tested.
1,000 days?
A hundred days.
Yeah, I was going
to say, it's closer
days,
to 100.
100 days, sorry.
Because we'd be years out. Okay.
Sorry about that. It's 100 days. I'm sorry. But anyway, it's 100 days. And they would have to get it in the ground, grow it, and then it has to be tested before it can go out. So, you know, you've got to have doctors writing prescriptions. There's a lot of moving parts in this,
right,
honestly. Well, and so it's not going to happen in September. And I was trying to pin down a timeline for when it might happen, and I couldn't get them to say anything. So we don't know when that's going to happen.
Well, Jesse, when you, with these inspections that are being done, what are they inspecting for? What are the criteria against which they're evaluating?
So essentially the way this works is a number of places, 12 large, and then they add in another one and 12 small marijuana cultivators. They got the go-ahead to like start getting going, like build your buildings and make sure they're secure and make sure you're able to plant these plants, et cetera.
All of this is indoors, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so that's, they get started on that. They build their facility, and then everything that they built and are prepared to go forward with needs to be inspected. And then the state says, okay, now you can start growing medical marijuana. So that's kind of the part where a lot of people are at. I spoke with the CEO of Cresco Labs, who is building out in Yellow Springs. And he said the challenge was they broke ground in December and then just had rain and snow. And we were all here for Ohio's winter this past mm-hmm. winter, and just had some trouble getting everything built, essentially. And so that's why they're a little bit delayed. They are expecting to have their inspection in the second week of July, and then thought that they could be going pretty soon after that. So if you kind of work that all out, that would be like mid-October. So certainly delayed from that September 8th deadline, but I don't think it's going to be quite as delayed as people fear. But still, any additional time is devastating to patients who thought that they were going to get this quicker than they are.
Well, I want to be clear, too, that these growers have already paid a significant amount of money to the state in fees and licenses and whatever. So it's not that there's a lack of funding to hire people to do the inspections or whatever. Am I correct on that? I mean, I saw a figure of $11 million has already been paid to the state before anything happens. Is that correct?
That is correct. I mean, they've already paid pretty hefty application fees, and those have been given already. So I think that the major thing is when they're doing these inspections, they have to meet all of the criteria that have been outlined. As far as security, as far as quality, as far as, you know, they've got to have the situation where the marijuana is being grown in a way that it can not affect the community, you know, as far as any kind of negative impacts or that sort of thing. So there's a very strict amount of things that a marijuana grower must meet when they go through this inspection. And like I said, the one inspection they had, the grower didn't meet it. So they have to go back and make changes. So I think that's going to be a key, is how many of them are going to be able to pass it on the first try, and how complicated is it going to be to try to get, you know, pass that inspection.
And Jesse, the growing is one part. What about the dispensing? Have licenses been issued for the dispensaries? Do companies, do businesses know in various communities that they have the rights to this, or is that also in process?
So the dispensaries were actually awarded earlier this week. So that is at least getting started. That was delayed a little bit, too. So it seems like every step of this process, from the growing to the selling to figuring out who's going to test it, to figuring out who's going to process it, to getting those cards out to patients and making sure that is well run, has just been a little bit behind schedule. And so it's not surprising that the whole process is a little behind schedule. So yes, they've been awarded, but I'm sure some of those people are going to have to ramp up and build buildings and get everything in line.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Are those dispensaries going to be focused strictly on the dispensing of medical marijuana, or could these be part of larger businesses?
Well, they're supposed to be, dispensing the marijuana. Now, what they're going to have to do, though, is they're going to have to work with the state in the way that they dispense this stuff, because, you know, this is not marijuana is still federally illegal. So you've got to get around that. And the state does have a system for that in place. But these retail establishments are going to have to work with the state to make sure that that system is in place and running on day one. It's not just a simple matter of having a credit card scanner or something like that in-house. They've got to actually work with the Department of Commerce to set that up. So I don't know how entailed that is, because we've never really seen this before. And, it may take a while to get that system going, too. We just don't know at this point.
Other states,
certainly, on one hand, you have this massive operation and multiple different state agencies overseeing it. So perhaps it's not surprising that it's taking a little bit to get off the ground. But on the other hand, it's not like we're the first state to legalize medical marijuana. We probably could have used a lot of the best practices from other locations, too.
Well, I'm sure there was some visitation and crossing and discussing, but you're right that starting something new has always got problems you don't foresee. So I want to thank both Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio and Jesse Ballmer from the Cincinnati Enquirer for joining us today to talk about what's going on in Ohio. Cincinnati City Council, the mayor and administration must approve a budget before the end of the month. Facing a more than $32 million deficit, combined with the need to improve emergency response systems, including a new technology and more staff, the pain point is the social services budget. Beyond the budget negotiations, the city abruptly changed the leadership of the 911 system. And then later, after graduation, where do Cincinnati's brightest young college graduates go? And how many will turn into salmon? To probe that, I got a reaction here. Good. To probe what this week's developments in Cincinnati are, we are joined by Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge, WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman, and Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Kate Murphy. Welcome, everyone. Glad to have you here. And I bumbled through that because I lost my paper.
Good to be back.
Yeah, very good, Sherry.
Your paper is as lost as a Cincinnati balanced budget.
Well, let's just start there, Jay. What is the situation right now? We had the manager come out with a proposed budget, the mayor weighing in and making some changes, which is normal. And now it's to council. So what are we really facing here?
Probably a couple of weeks of uncertainty and a lot of backroom deals, and see if they can get to five votes to pass a budget. And if there are some things that the mayor doesn't like, then they probably better make sure that they can get to six votes, because he could well veto those parts and they'll have to start over.
So one of the manager's proposal was much harder on the social services sector than what the mayor wants. He wants to bring a lot of that back. So what's the fight there, and what's going on?
You know, I think from the manager's perspective is like, I got to take care of the city. I have a $32 million shortfall. And, you know, when you're looking at all of the essential things you want to do, which is police and fire, it's the social services that, from that very critical thinking of city services, that seems easy to cut. But that's really not the will of the mayor and the council. That's where it becomes political. It's like, what are your ideals? What's in your heart? Like, the mayor restored some of the money for Hand Up, like his job training program, something he ran on in 2013. And so that becomes like the city manager is like a critical thinker of city services. But when we start talking about council and the mayor, it's our priorities and what we want the city to be. And so that's where you see the differences, I think.
And in all reality, the mayor really didn't tinker that much with the general fund budget. You're talking, I think the total general fund budget is north of $400 million.
406.
And the mayor added essentially $1.6 million worth of spending. So it's not... And over, in the grand scheme of things, there was some tinkering, but it's not major tinkering. But that tinkering is going to get a lot of attention.
But there's $32 million shortfall in the budget, or at least there was as of last week. So if he adds 1.6,
then it, but he covered
did
that
he,
with
did
other.
He, did he cover it?
Right. No, they.
So the manager has a balanced budget and the mayor has a balanced budget, just different ways?
Yes, on paper. That's going to be an argument too. Is the budget ever structurally balanced? We hear that a lot. I think we were joking yesterday that was going to be our drinking game. How many times we hear the word structural balance? But I mean, the budget is probably structurally balanced on July 1st, the day it goes into effect. By the time they do the first update at the end of July, if there's any fluctuation one way or the other, it's not structurally balanced anymore.
I mean, the difference is between balanced and structurally balanced, the idea of one-time money being used to pay for something that's an ongoing thing, which then becomes a problem in the out years. But the truth of the matter is, covering City Hall now, I don't know, 5 years, the readers, they never react to whether this budget is structurally balanced. They want to know about the things they see every day. They want to know about paving. They actually think they care about the fleet and, you know, their police officers responding. So we try and focus on that. And city council can say structurally balanced or not all they want, but we're going to write what the citizens want to hear.
Go ahead, Jim.
No, I was just going to say probably one thing that we're going to watch is the funding for the Center for the Closing the Health Gap.
Well, I was going to get to that because
all right, well, I'll...
talk about political. I mean, that's as political as it comes because closing the Center for the closing the Health Gap is headed by Dwight Tillery, former mayor. In the early years under Mayor Cranley, that the city contribution to that got boosted to $1 million. Then it got cut back to about $750,000.
And that was by their choice.
And only because there really was a tough budget that had nothing to do with any controversy.
Right.
And then this year, the Cranley proposal is to zero that out. What's going on there? We don't just zero it out because it's a tough budget.
This is a combination of politics and accountability. There's certainly politics at play here on behind the scenes, how people get along with Dwight and these elected officials. But there is also an accountability issue. Council was very, very serious about having outcomes after, you know, some things were raised with some problems. And none of – under this former city manager, Harry Black, that was completely ignored. I mean, we spent a lot of time in City Hall listening to how we were going to hold all these outside groups accountable. And really, none of that came to fruition. And that's – playing into this? Like, what are the outcomes?
So is that – that was the manager, in that case, Harry Black, when
yes.
he was here, not Dwight Tillery and closing the healthcare gap's responsibility?
Well, I mean, I think they have a responsibility to be accountable no matter what their contract says and to show their outcomes and what they've done. And, you know, David Mann, I think he put it best. He's the budget and finance chair. You know, he's tepid about what's going to happen here. And he said, I want to see what the outcomes are. And honestly, I'm looking forward to seeing what the outcomes are, too. I myself and WCPO and Dan Horn, we wrote a lot about, you know, all of this spending 2 years ago now. And I would like to see, you know, changes and what their outcomes are right now.
What do you expect Dwight Tillery to do at this point?
I expect, well, so far we know that he has got a postcard campaign. As of this morning, there were 73. Basically, it's a fill-in-the-blank postcard. You fill your name in and sign it and mail it to City Hall. So far, there have been 73 of those. And I suspect that he will probably be well represented at all three of the public hearings next Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday
evening. He did send a representative to see what was going on yesterday, but there was no speaking and no crowd. So I haven't seen these postcards, Jay. Do they have like a campaign literature like paid for by somebody?
I don't believe so. I tweeted a picture of it, but I don't know. It did not have a paid for. It was just basically a pre-printed postcard. Hi, my name is. You write your name in. Some are signing at the bottom, some are not. And I saw it as a communication in the council system, and there were 73 of them as of noon today.
Well, one of the things we talked about last week, Jay, and I just want to make clear that in John Cranley's proposal, he has – one of the things he's restored is the funding for some of the business groups, like the African American Chamber, Greater Cincinnati Development Authority, better known as the Port, and READY have been restored. And so that's important just to note here that is not just the social services budget.
Right. That's for economic development activities. And if the mayor hadn't restored those, I suspect council would have restored it anyway. Okay. So that's one less thing that the council have to add back in.
Something that hasn't been talked about with the funding that he put back, he called it for job stuff, for jobs. And it is that. Those places all are they're job drivers. But they're also, a couple of them are, predominantly to help the Black community. And, over time with the Black agenda, talking about like disparity, and there's some council members, Tamaya's committee is looking at disparity in city policies. Cutting those things really, if you take a look, it was cutting things that help the minority community. And it becomes disparity if you don't put them back in.
Okay. One thing, the other thing too, on the real just quickly on the capital budget. Now, the mayor did add like $5.2 million to the capital budget, and he accomplished that by taking the remaining money from the Blue Ash Airport sale, one TIF fund, and then he made a number of cuts, which there's probably a dozen or so cuts that were within the capital budget to the tune of $3.75 million. And I know some council members have some cuts or have some questions about what do those cuts really mean? And city administrators are working on a memo to explain, here's what was proposed, here's what the mayor's cuts would mean to those programs.
If there was just more Blue Ash land to sell.
I think that $1 million wipes it out.
I do want to bring up one point that we haven't mentioned yet that I do think that citizens really care about. The mayor's put a big priority on litter pickup. Mm-hmm. There's like some renewed partnership with Keep Cincinnati Beautiful. He's adding these 5 litter crews. Mm-hmm. I hear things that I hear just from readers when they just reach out randomly, their MSD bills and litter. I get a lot of people being like, can you help me with your litter problem? And it's like, well, here's the city number. People care about that, and it's a big problem. And the mayor here, out of the kind of the clear blue, I feel like, is really addressing that.
So before we get on to something else, Greg Landsman has raised the possibility that not for this year's budget, but we need to look at an increase in the earnings tax.
I was just going to say we need to talk about that.
Yeah. This is on the table.
Each year that they do one of these budgets, I think, okay, this is the last year that they can possibly balance, a big deficit with no new revenue. And seemingly, they're able to balance the budget with some cuts, and there is new revenue in the form of fee increases. But they're just – Landsman made a point of that yesterday. When you're trying to balance a budget, first you do cuts, then you do fees, and then when the fees don't work, you either have to figure out new revenue or you have to make more drastic cuts. And I think they're probably – each year they get closer, and I don't see how many more years they can keep pulling a rabbit out of their hat to balance the budget without some sort of significant new revenue source.
Well, very quickly, I want to also bring up the fact that Julie Sellers, the head of the Cincinnati Federation of Teachers, and the CFT itself, have gone public and telling the city they have to stop giving deals to developers, that this is hurting the schools. How much clout does the CFT have inside City Hall?
We don't see them a lot there. But, P.G. Sittenfeld's committee is the education committee. He seems to be taking this very seriously and starting the conversation now. And he seems to be concerned about the school's budget and what's happening there. And so I think we're going to have a very real discussion about this year.
And that's in advance. There was an agreement in 1999 that will end at the end of 2019 Originally, it dates back to the stadiums when the stadiums were built and they would not pay property taxes. Hamilton County and Cincinnati both agreed to make a $5 million annual payment to the schools. That runs out next year. And as part of the city agreement, there was also the payment in lieu of taxes where developers pay a portion of what the developed property would be worth to the schools. So that all is up for renegotiation.
This also gives me a chance to get Kate Murphy into this discussion, who has been very patient out there. Kate, you've been working on this story about the teachers as well.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, kind of at the crux of it is that CPS, you know, is based on their kind of review of city records, that they have been losing out on 8.4, even considering, you know, that money that the city pays to the district to compensate for these tax breaks. And so they're really, you know, trying to kind of shed light on this money that they, and as well as other local services, are missing out on. And they've, you know, kind of identified four major points that they, you know, need. You know, that $5 million that the city gives, that was made back in 1999. And, you know, they're kind of arguing that that needs to be reevaluated, and that is not the $5 million then is, you know, we need more than that now. And looking at where those tax breaks are where the money from those tax breaks are going, you know, is really a big point of this too, is that, you know, they're seeing these go to those thriving neighborhoods and not really the parts within the neighborhoods within the school district that really need that extra financial support, that are struggling. And so it's just kind of rejiggering this agreement. And, you know, yeah, certainly this meeting on Tuesday was really the first step in kind of bringing this discussion back up to the table to see how, you know, these two groups, you know, with City Hall and, you know, the teachers can really work together to find a way to make this work for the teachers who, you know, are really arguing that they're missing out on a lot of money and that needs to be fixed.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, of course, we're on the heels of Exhibit A, which is the Major League Soccer Stadium. Like the schools, you know, at the first, you know, financial discussions, it wasn't even in adherence to this agreement that was signed and getting ready to expire. And so in the end, it does adhere to that agreement. But it's like, is that enough? Is it, I mean, that got a lot of attention and brought this agreement right into the spotlight. And so we are on the heels of that.
And some council members have even hinted that, you know, it's time to look at the city's tax abatement policies. And they're questioning, do you really need to offer abatements in areas that are hopping? They point to downtown right. And parts of over the Rhine. And I think even Julie Sellers pointed that out in her letter that, you know, I think they're okay with tax abatements, but they need to be in neighborhoods that have a genuine need for economic development.
And we do need to say, too, that while there is a discussion with the teachers, it's actually with the school board.
Right.
It's like this. And so, you know, they're the ones here. Like, really, there's going to be some big decision making coming there.
OK, Kate, I want to get to another topic that you covered this week, and that is the shakeup at 911. The police officer who had been Captain Gramke, who was heading the 911 operation, all of a sudden got dismissed or replaced, I think is the right way, still in the police force, by the city manager. And Jason Dunn, and by the way, this is J-A-Y-S-O-N, Dunn. There are a million Jason Dunns.
I can't tell you how many times I've called the wrong one.
There's a lot of them out there. But Jason Dunn, who has a history with the Hamilton County 911 system and also oversees technology for the city, he's now been put in charge. So it's been moved from back to oversight by a civilian. What's the significance of this, and how surprised were you that this happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all surprised. You know, it's very clear that the city is making changes, and this leadership change is obviously a big one of those. You know, as these different fixes are underway within the 911 center, really in response to Kyle Plush's death, you know, it's interesting to see this new takeover and, you know, kind of reverting back to a different kind of leadership. And that, I mean, definitely was surprising to us and, you know, to the Police Union President Dan Hills as well. You know, I think they're certainly confused as to they thought that, you know, things were moving in the right direction and that these changes were best suited and would see through, see those changes through under Gramsci. And, you know, it kind of seems like, you know, going back to under that civilian control, there's a lot of confusion and concern over that. But I guess, you know, we'll just kind of have to see how things shake out and what, you know, what immediate impact and what changes.
Yeah.
You quote Dan Hills as saying that civilian control, quote, wrecked the place last time.
Yeah.
I think he made pretty clear how he thinks about this.
Right.
The one thing that it will be interesting about this is, you know, council is demanding weekly updates on the 911 center. And so how things are going, it is going to be very transparent about, like, what happens next. So we hear every Wednesday, like, things that are new and all the things that happened the week
Although
before.
Although I can't help but the irony, there was this big shakeup on Tuesday, and the manager did his update on Wednesday. Not a word was mentioned about new leadership at the Emergency Communication Center.
Yeah.
I thought that was very strange that, you know,
we all knew.
Everyone knew, but you would have thought that. And I think the reporters were hoping, okay, this is where the city manager, the acting city manager will explain more, and nothing was said.
Well, I mean, there's the question of Captain Gramsci or Jason Dunn, police leadership or civilian leadership. But the other side of this is there have been a lot of changes in terms of the leadership of the 911 center over the last 4 or 5 years. And instability, no matter who's leading, you can have great people, but if you keep changing them,
you've
got
problems. Director number 4 or number 5?
5.
5 and 4 years, I think.
Yeah,
right? I mean, this is problematic just on its face. Would you agree?
Well, they're making, you know, several other changes throughout the center in general. And so, yeah, I mean, it's obviously very interesting to see this new leadership coming in, you know, as all of these other moving parts are happening around them with getting new mapping technology, with hiring more staff, you know, changing protocols and procedures for officers and dispatchers. It's very interesting how that will play out in the type of leadership that and decision making that he'll bring to that role.
But what we don't know is what happened to spur this change, and like maybe we really needed this change. I don't know. Citizens don't know. No one is saying. Like the last time I heard that he was the magic man and he was going to be amazing. He was like, this was great, and he's the best. That's the last thing I heard on the record, and so. Maybe we really do need a change and they know something. They're just not telling us. But again, they're not telling us.
As Kate said, when the memo came Tuesday afternoon, I was just kind of, huh, that's strange. Because I thought it, like Sherry said, that Gramsci, everyone was making it appear that he was the guy to fix this.
Okay, Kate, I've got one more area for you, another topic.
Yeah.
And that is, where do our students go after they graduate from college? Now, in setting all this up, I used a term that at the Chamber of Commerce, when I was the head of leadership Cincinnati, we referred to all the time, Cincinnati salmon. People graduate, they go away, and they come back. You know, it may be 5 years, it may be 7 years, but they all come back. So what's the significance, you know, you outlined from UC, XU, Miami, NKU, where people go, and what's the significance of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that, and so I'm new to Cincinnati, and ever since I moved here, you know, it's been very clear that this is a hometown city, and people, you know, even if they go away, you know, they always tend to come back, and, you know, we definitely see that from this, that, you know, more than 50% of University of Cincinnati alumni are moving to Cincinnati, and that has been consistent throughout, you know, the past 10 years, which is really remarkable, you know, especially considering the high profile that UC has grown, and, you know, bringing in students from more than Ohio too. I think, you know, also these young students that are coming to Miami and Xavier and NKU and UC the city itself is growing so much. And I think, you know, that's Cincinnati is becoming a really attractive place for, you know, post-grad students who are, you know, kind of looking to make a mark and figure out what they want to do with their life. You know, Cincinnati has become more and more appealing to that younger generation, myself included. And so it's, you know, I think that's really telling is that, you know, the integration that these universities have really tried to, you know, get their students involved with the businesses and with the community in Cincinnati itself is tying those students, you know, closer to want to stay where they went to school. And, I mean, that's really a great thing for the city moving forward, I think, to have that young talent. And there's, you know, a lot of job growth that these universities are looking to fill within our own city. And, you know, it's clear that they're placing these students not just, you know, in a place where friends might be, but from, you know, a job standpoint, you know, we want you to stay here. And so I think it's really telling, too, that these universities are committed to keeping their graduates here and building up, you know, this city with a lot of young talent. And, you know, it's clear that they've been doing a pretty good job considering how many people move here.
Well, thank you, Kate. And I want to also thank Jay and Sherry for being with us. But right now, we're going to focus at the end of the week on good news. Good news for the Cincinnati Zoo, and especially for the zoo's elephants. To catch us up, we are joined now by WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. And Tana, this has got big dollar signs, and therefore
a lot big dollar signs. A lot of fundraising.
Besides the elephants being big,
right? Yes,
the dollars are big.
Yeah, a lot of fundraising about to happen at the zoo. $150 million capital campaign. Now they got a big boost on that. $50 million of that.
It's called a lead gift.
A lead gift from the Fath, Harry and Linda Fath, from their family, made a big contribution. So now they are going to start the process of fundraising. They want to build a 5-acre yard for the elephants, so they'll have more space. They can then expand to an entire herd, 8 to 10 elephants. So some breeding there.
One of the things that confused me a little bit, mm-hmm. it's all in their 2025 master plan.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're going to move to the parking area that's connected to the safari area.
Right.
Are the elephants going to be on top of a garage? Is that what I'm understanding? There's going to be a parking garage. And then the elephants are all going to be on top, and I'm just wondering about parking in that garage.
I'm getting the head nod yes from Jay. I hadn't really thought about it, but I guess that's right.
Yeah, yeah. That's going to be kind of interesting. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
So the idea is to really give the elephants enough space to do a lot of things.
Right, yeah, have more home to roam is their tagline. So, and we get kangaroos and wallabies, and the black rhino breeding program will get a boost too, and they'll have more room as well.
And an overhead zip line or something.
Zip line,
right?
And a beer garden.
And a beer garden. Well, it must be Cincinnati, and it's Friday. Thank you, Tam.
Yes, you're welcome.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. Selena Reeder is our assistant producer. Layla Shikui is our intern. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.